We're looking at Daniel chapter 3 today, and Daniel chapter 3 is about God's superior power in his servant's faithfulness. And the focus is on God's superior power. This earlier part of the book of Daniel has a clear, what we call a chiastic structure, and that means that chapter 2 mirrors chapter 7, chapter 3 mirrors chapter 6, chapter 4 mirrors chapter 5. And they're dealing with the same sort of point. And this section is kind of bookended because the book starts off, chapter 1 in Hebrew, and then in these chapters, starting with chapter 2 right through chapter 7, you've got the different language, Aramaic, another Semitic language, but it's a different language, and then it goes back after chapter 7 to Hebrew again. So you've got that clear, visible clue there in the change of language, that this is a panel and there are parts of it. The first part reflects the last, the third chapter then reflects the sixth chapter, the fourth, the fifth, and so on. So the second chapter is a statue dream about four kingdoms. And in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel has a vision of his own in which he sees four mutant beasts, the four kingdoms of mankind rising up and so on. And chapter 3 is about three faithful Jews being challenged over their faithfulness. And chapter 6 is about Daniel in the lion's den being challenged over his faithfulness. Do you see the point? So the chiastic counterpart of this chapter 3 of Daniel is chapter 6. And both are stories of God's faithful people who face death because of their faithfulness to God. Yes, they do. But the big point is that God miraculously delivers them out of it, simply to prove himself more powerful than the pagan gods of the nations. And that's the message. So the primary purpose of this chapter is not to showcase the fact that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are better than the rest of Babylon, great guys, which they undoubtedly are, but to highlight the absolute supremacy of their God. And there's an awful lot of repetition in this story. So the people hearing it could almost start joining in with it as it was read. I was listening to a sermon from Abba Sachan with John Funnell yesterday evening myself, and he does this with people. He gets them to join in and repeat what he says. It's fascinating to watch. And there's this repetition then in the story. It's verses 15 to 18 that make the point that this story addresses. If you do not worship it, you'll be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace, says the king. And then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? We're about to find out. We're about to see, Nebuchadnezzar, exactly what God can do a thing like that, because his power is greater than yours. Not about how good these three are, but about how powerful their God is. So in verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, King Neb, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it. And he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of the gold you've set up. And just as at the end of chapter 2, where the point was how Daniel's God had superior wisdom and knowledge, it is again the king who is the one who hammers home the point of what this chapter is about in the resolution of this story in chapter 3, just as in chapter 2. So here in chapter 3, in verse 29, it is the king himself, King Nebu, says, no other God can save in this way. The God of these three has superior power. And that's against the context where chapter 3 begins with, first of all, Nebuchadnezzar's first display of his power. Verses 1 to 7 are all about that. Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. We're not told any time reference as to when, but there it is. First of all, then, there's this statue, verse 1. Now, in chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed of a statue. And right next to it, in chapter 3, you get him making a statue. Even more elaborate than the one in chapter 2. That statue had a head of gold, and Daniel told him from God, well, that represents you and your kingdom, King Neb. It had a head of gold, but this one in this chapter is made entirely of gold, and it's huge. It stands 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. That's 90 feet tall and 9 feet wide. Now, the glaringly obvious thing there, of course, is that this thing is really out of proportion for the statue of a human figure, and it looks like it's going to fall over. Because it's an awful lot longer than it's wide. You see? Interesting, isn't it? It's going to fall over. And that's what's in Daniel's dream in chapter 2. And there are suggestions, maybe as a smaller human statue on top of an obelisk. There were similar things apparently in Babylon, archaeologists can tell us about. But otherwise, it's a pretty weird representation of a human being. But the close association with chapter 2 and the golden part of that statue being gold, and the building of this totally gold statue here, does suggest this is pretty likely to be Neb setting up a statue of himself and requiring emperor worship of all his subjects. It is rank idolatry at the very best, and the idol seems to be designed to be him. So there stands the statue. There's a big event to follow then. He's going to have a launch party. Verses 2 to 7, the big event. Striking thing about this event here is that the king says come, and they all come. It's a great long list of dignitaries and office holders who come. That list keeps on getting repeated. All these guys. And then the second thing about that is that the king says bow down, and they all bow down. All of them. And anybody who was anybody was there. That ridiculously long list of officials gets repeated. That ridiculously long list of instruments gets repeated. Are you seeing this point? And then, throughout this account, the big striking thing is the king says to build a statue, and they build a statue, and the king says to come, and everybody comes, and the king says to everybody, and everybody, they bow down. The king is vaunting the power to say this, to do this, and it is done. And it's ridiculous. It's idolatrous. It's all about the claim to be the one with a great power being made by this king. Now, if you go back through the scriptures and search out just who it is that actually does have the power and the authority to say, do this and it is done, well, it isn't Nebuchadnezzar. Because that's how God made the world and everything in it from the very start. Let there be, and there was. Let it be, and it was. Nebuchadnezzar, big statue of gold, all these people, great big party, worship me, says Neb. That's a sort of storyline that'd be fantastic storyline for a grand opera, wouldn't you think? Well, in fact, it got written in 1841. Nabucco is the opera that's considered to have permanently established Verdi's reputation as a composer. It's a fantastic story. But with terrible things going on in it. We're heading into the setup for the big dramatic denouement as we get the big betrayal of the idolatry-resistant Hebrews in verses 8 to 12. And here's the second thing, the second major section of this chapter 3 of Daniel, the big betrayal, verses 8 to 12. We're told certain Chaldeans come forward to the king, and they tell him in tones of ethnic prejudice, these Jews who you appointed, that certain Jews didn't bow down. How did the Chaldeans know that if they were bowing down? Well, that's an interesting question. In any event, they bring a malicious accusation, but it is true that the three Hebrew men did not bow down. It's just the intention that's malicious. And this would have be seen as insubordination and treason to the king, who expects to be able to say, do it, and it's done. So their lives are now very immediately, very perilously on the line with a brutal, self-idolizing monarch. It tells us these guys accused are the Jews, and they're described as these men who you, O king, appointed. Race-based ethnic rivalry here. And for whatever reason, the accusers don't like these Hebrews. They do look as if they're being pretty malicious. And yet these three men, these Hebrew lads, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they've broken a serious law, and they're liable for the death sentence as a result. There it is. That's really all that's going on here in these verses. This section just serves to take us to the next one, which informs our thinking by means of this human power play between the three and the over-vaunted king. So thirdly then, verses 13 to 20, there's this interaction between the king and the three men. And it's here in this section of the chapter, this third section, that the really big stuff gets stated. In it, the arrogant, God-defying king is going to blow up, and he's going to develop the challenge to faith at the centre of the whole chapter. So here's the king. The challenge is explicit in verse 15. Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you're ready to fall down, worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you'll be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. And then, says the king, then what God will be able to rescue you from my hand? See that last bit? That's the point. Nebuchadnezzar seems to be giving them a second chance, but he's saying and re-emphasizing, what God is powerful enough to deliver you out of my hand? There's the challenge. It's a huge claim. It's the claim of a human king to be more powerful than any other god out there. Who has ultimate power? Look, actually see what's going on here. The king is challenging the idea that the God of the Bible is the sovereign God. It's a remarkable claim. But as Wendy Widder says, that is a challenge that the God of the Bible will take. So for the first time, only time now, the three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, speak. And they don't speak individually, they speak as if one, as if united as one character in the storyline. The three men. The king does that. He challenges divine sovereignty. The three men, in some ways, these guys, as that single unit, they represent the ideal Jew. But the great big shocking thing in that culture that would really hit home is the way that these three guys address King Neb in verse 16. By his name, rather than, O King, live forever, or something like that. Well, you'd never do that. King Nebuchadnezzar, they say, oh, you don't do that. It's more than a breach of protocol. Now, there's a more respectful way of construing the Aramaic, I'm aware of that, but you almost have here what sounds like impudence or disrespect, and what you make of that determines what you make of the rest of what they say. There's an anomalous sentence structure in the Aramaic, which makes it possible that various translations are correct. But in terms of the structure and the way the sentences, the way the Aramaic seems to work, it looks like this last... The last one that I've come across really is the best. If our God is able, he will deliver us. It's likely that's the translation most faithful to the actual text. If our God is able, he will deliver us. Now, we don't go for that, and the main translations of the Bible over the years haven't gone for that. We don't like the sound of that. We don't like the sound of these guys that we're trying to make the heroes of the faith, which is not what the chapter's about. We don't like the sound of that because it makes those men look as if they're a bit ponderous in their faith, rather than big and brassy and bold in challenging idolatry. And that makes us feel uncomfortable, the thought that they could be leaving room for the way God might not deliver them. Well, that's a realistic prospect for them, you see. We feel uncomfortable with that kind of suggestion, that they're actually saying, well, if our God is able, he could deliver us. He will deliver us. Makes us feel uncomfortable. That's no reason to reject what the best analysis of the text tells us, though, is the best translation. Because if we discounted everything in the Bible that made us feel uncomfortable, we'd be in real trouble, right? Remember, this isn't the propositional truth these guys are living. This is reflecting their thoughts, possibly even their doubts. And it seems important to remember they are in exile because their God had not delivered them on the major previous occasion from the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. So it's possible these three men are reflecting, as the typical representation of their people, some common pattern of doubt that these people really had. Why didn't our God deliver us, and why are we here in Babylon? It's a difficult passage because of the language, and it gives us something to chew over. John Cook, he's a grammarian in Hebrew and Aramaic. He reckons they're saying that the three are putting aside the issue of whether God is going to deliver them or not. Whether he does or not, we are not going to bow down. And that's a new take on this verse. I'm aware of it. We need to give it time to air in the groves of academe to have this really groundbreaking work that's been done on the Aramaic grammar evaluated. But at the end of the day, what matters is whatever happens, the three are still not going to bow down. They will not violate the first and second commandments, no matter what. So, they are not going to conform. Are the three going to take a huge risk with the good name of their God? Well, bear this in mind. If their God doesn't deliver, then the king is still going to be shown to be powerless. Because he couldn't even get these three rather young men, captive men, to bow down and worship his idolatrous way as specified, in spite of threatening them with the worst that he's got. He's shown to be weak just by their response. So the king gets angry. He has lots of hot words. It's an interesting storytelling device here. Look at this. The king gets hot, then the furnace gets hot. Then the king gets hotter again, and then the furnace is heated up seven times hotter. And you can't take that as a measure, by the way. There wasn't a knob on the front of the furnace. They didn't rotate it from gas mark 5 to like gas mark 7. Number 7 is the number of completion. So this furnace is as hot as it can possibly be. Completely hot. And who does the king call to throw the boys in? Verse 20. Daniel 3:20. Some of his strongest men. What happens when they throw the three in? Some of the king's mightiest men fall dead, but the three fall in and yet are seen to be walking about in the flames. And interestingly, they're described as wearing all sorts of combustible garments in there. The materials are specified and they are fire prone, but those clothes are not burned up. There's no way those guys should come out alive, let alone leave the furnace without even a whiff of fire on them. Well, verses 21 to 25 then, fourthly. These men, they are the subject of God's response to the king's display of power with his own display of power. Daniel 3, 21 to 25. Daniel is not in the picture. He will be in the mirroring passage later on in Daniel 6. But what happens here is that those three men are in the fire and Nebuchadnezzar sees a fourth man in the fire. Now, it's only Nebuchadnezzar who sees that fourth man in the fire. And Nebuchadnezzar reports that the fourth man in the fire has the appearance of a son of the gods, unquote. A son of the gods. The Aramaic is not being faithfully rendered by translations that say the son of God or whatever. Nebuchadnezzar does not at this point have a clear understanding of Jesus, and Daniel 3 is not saying that, however tasty a morsel that might seem to us. What the king means is that he's looking at what seems to be a supernatural being, not another being like the three men. This is a very distinct sort of being. And what does the unique being do? The men fall right into the heart of the fire, no parachute, no lifeline thrown down quickly from heaven to pull them out or for them to climb up. Does this supernatural being they're with in the fire get them out of there? The amazing thing, he does not. You might be asking, what sort of rescue story is it where the people rescued are left in a fiery furnace, heated up as fully as possible? Now, the fourth man seems to be in it, in there with them. See, this is not the way it is so often preached, a promise that God will deliver faithful people because they're being good. Today, in many parts of the world, God is not doing that for very faithful people. I don't think we can decide from Scripture what we might wish to decide, that is that God delivers his faithful people from this world's catastrophes, full stop. Hebrews 11, with its talk of faithful people being devoured by lions or sawn in half between two planks of wood, that tends to suggest that saying that God always delivers you if you stay faithful to him is patently wrong. This one, like a son of the gods, does not deliver God's faithful people out of that fire, but he's in there with them. And when it comes to getting out of the fire, they get up and walk out of it themselves in due course. See, if God does deliver his people in this world, it's not for any other reason than for his glory. If you can't live faithfully with that, then you've fallen into the trap of holding an overrealized eschatology, which is at least every bit as serious a complaint as it sounds. You don't want to go telling the faithful martyrs of this world that if they'd been faithful enough, they wouldn't have been killed. And that's the implication of the way this story is often preached. No, this is the descriptive account, not a prescriptive theology of the unbreakable connection between being faithful and getting released from the consequences that you fear. Do you see how ludicrous the idea sounds when you put it like that? This is not a rescue story, a self-rescue. They self-extricate, to use the jargon, in due course. But they're walking around with this fourth person with them in the fire. Well, fifthly then, and here comes the denouement, verses 26 to 29, Nebuchadnezzar calls the men out. The satraps and so on, the highest officials, are witness to the fact that the three come out at the king's bidding. He's clearly changed his mind about this furnace and these boys now. And that as they do so, they are clearly untouched by the fire in any way, except for one. Can you see what it is? The ropes that had bound them had fallen off in the fire, where we saw they'd been walking around unbound. And the king is really impressed. And he makes a big statement. He seems to be doing so well in the first part of that statement, verse 28. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own god, yea, Neb." Except, he's learning, but he's not making great strides, because he goes on immediately in verse 29. "Therefore I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces, and their houses be burned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way." He hasn't quite got there yet, hasn't he? Well, in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar meets the God who had superior knowledge and understanding way above the king's grasp. And in this chapter, chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar meets the God who has superior power way above the king's own grasp and sends one like a son of God, the gods, to stand with them in that fire. And the king is amazingly impressed by that. Let's come to a conclusion. What was that fourth figure doing in the fire? What was he doing there? Was he in there getting them out? No. God delivered them from the fire. Was he going around covering them with fire blankets and shielding them from the fire? No. God stopped them, even in their highly combustible garments, from getting burned up in the fire. So what was he doing in there? He wasn't in there for anyone who didn't see him, and only the king saw him. What was he doing in there for Nebuchadnezzar? Two things. The whole event showed the king a grand display of God's power. It makes it obvious the whole thing was down to God and his power, not to anything special in those three guys. It wasn't that they were special. A little while before, they weren't even sure their king was going to deliver them. The second thing he's there for, firstly, to display God's power. This is God's power at work. The second thing he's there for is, it kept him from thinking these three guys themselves had delivered themselves because they were gods. And there was a danger of that in a context where idolatry and the worship of humans as gods was a possibility. It's God showing the king that God was the one doing these things. What are the takeaways from this story? It's about idolatry. And in the contrast, that these guys are not being faithful to God so that he will pull them out of a hole. That's how idolatry thinks and functions itself. That's penny in the slot religion. No, these guys are faithful to God because he's God. They didn't stay faithful because that would fix things for them. They didn't do it because God was their fire insurance. They were committed to honour God in life and in death. They were faithful to live or to die in his uncompromised service, no matter what. He was God, and they were going to follow him no matter what. And that faithfulness does not always lead to deliverance. In later chapters, people are going to suffer worse things than even these three suffered. They will be martyrs in the Bible. But in the midst of what they suffered, God was with. He was amongst his faithful people. So then, the previous chapter was all about God's superior knowledge and understanding, the ability to describe and interpret the dream. And this chapter is all about God's superior and his faithful presence with his faithful people. And Nebuchadnezzar himself sums that up in what he says at the end. There's no God who can save like the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He's recognized superior power when he sees it. Neb had done all he could that was within his power to make that furnace 7 times hotter even. And the strongest and the best of his men fell at the door of that furnace as they threw the three guys in. And by the power of God, they're seen walking around in that fire. It's really not so much about our faithfulness leading to deliverance. It's about the power contest between Nebuchadnezzar and God. What God can save you from this, he'd said at the beginning. Only the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego can, he says at the end. This is really not so much about our faithfulness leading to deliverance. It's about the supremacy of our sovereign God. And guaranteed deliverance lies in his hand. But it may well lie beyond here.